So I'm pleased that we are taking these 3 weeks in a row a focus on the first three foundations of mindfulness. So going back to traditional teachings from most likely 2,600 years ago that have tremendous relevance now in their simplicity and their power. And I think there was a cover of Time magazine. Probably, I think there have been a few covers with various titles like the Mindfulness Revolution, or just the way that mindfulness is going into more and more parts of life. Actually, earlier today, I was teaching at a one-day retreat held by a group of physicians who work for Contra Costa County. And I was working with them, and in part we were exploring mindfulness. We also worked with some of the heart practices, like gratitude and compassion and empathy, and related a lot of it to patient care. But mindfulness has gone in a powerful way into medicine, law, education, association called Mindful Schools that Orin has worked with, has taught, I think, close to 20,000 students mindfulness, right? It's in sports. Those of you who are here today have made a choice not to see in live time the local successful sports team. So I thank you for your sacrifice for the sake of deep spiritual practice. And but you may know, or you may not know, I like to mention it, that the Warriors have four core principles. The first is mindfulness. The second is compassion. The third is joy. And the fourth is competition. And so we have sports, and we have psychology, most of the main different institutions, really. I mean, people are bringing it into many, many areas. And so we get some time to devote our practice to these very core teachings. And last time we looked at the first foundation of mindfulness, and I don't know, is the recording up at this point? Yeah, so recording is up on the first foundation, it's not up, on mindfulness of the body. Right? And so today the focus is on mindfulness of what is translated, I think, best as feeling tone. And I'll talk a little bit about the translation, the sense of pleasant or unpleasant or neutral. And I'll come back in a moment just to explain why this is so significant. Because, okay, mindfulness of the body, got it, important. Pay attention to the body. Mindfulness of thoughts and emotions, which is more or less the third foundation, really important. Mindfulness of feeling tone, pleasant and pleasant. Why is that listed? How did that make the top four? There are only four foundations, right? Was it a bribe by someone who had special interest in this area? So what I want to do is to talk about mindfulness of feeling tone, why it's so important, and I would say it's right at the heart of our practice, actually. And I want to make that case, and then talk about ways to practice, hopefully interesting us or inspiring us for the next week. And we can come back and compare notes, just as today, I hope, in the discussion time, to hear some of how you've explored mindfulness of the body. Again, part of my interest is to explicate the text in a way that's accessible. Part of it is to identify a series of practices and see if one or two of them resonate with you. We explore two of them in the meditation. So mindfulness in general is this capacity to be aware with a steady attention. Mindfulness requires steadiness. It requires the capacity to stay with what is there in our experience. Interestingly, we in the four foundations, each of them is on a particular part of experience. So we don't just say be mindful, we say be mindful and especially look out for this. Focus on the body, focus on feeling tone, focus on this, and develop mindfulness in these ways. So mindfulness is not just a general guidance, but it's a specific guidance about looking in these areas and seeing them as significant. I think I mentioned last time that I like to often frame mindfulness as having three main ways of practicing. One of them, sometimes when we're busy or things are moving more quickly, is just to notice what's there. We can have a label. We're at a meeting, we notice anger coming through because of what just happened, right? And to note it, to have the label, anger, is a very important dimension of mindfulness. It's to know what's occurring. To know what's occurring, this is the basis for skillful response. If we don't know what's happening in our experience, we're on automatic, which occurs a lot. Occurs a lot for us. So we want to be able to notice. And that can just be, we just notice what's happening. And that can happen in our formal meditation or in the flow of daily life. The second way of practicing is to explore what a given experience is like. This is when there's usually greater duration in the experience. When a sense maybe of pleasant is quite strong, it stays for a while, we can say, okay, what's it like? What is this experience of pleasant like? You can really especially do this at meals. You know, have some, you know, set yourself up with some pleasant food and track what the experience of pleasant is like with that food. When I was teaching on feeling tone to a group, I said, you know, it actually doesn't matter what's happening, the key is to explore. I said, we could just be eating chocolate this whole time. And it's not the pleasant isn't the problem. It's actually, as we'll see, it's what happens with it. So they said, the next time, let's do it. So we ate chocolate and we explored pleasant experiences, mostly. And so we can explore, investigate, what's it like in the body? What's the narrative? Especially valuable with unpleasant experiences when we get reactive. What's going on? What's happening? What's it like in the body? How does it change? What does it become? What are the thoughts? Where does it go? And so forth. And that starts, you know, a practice like mindfulness of feeling tone can actually bring a lot of interest and inquiry into our meditations. So it's not just about kind of generally getting calm and peaceful. I'm afraid that meditation in the West, sometimes, I was going to say, deteriorates to that. Of course, there's nothing wrong with being relaxed and peaceful, but that's not the heart of it. Right? The heart of it is to actually see clearly what's happening. And so sometimes our meditation gets a little bit stale, and we just kind of get into a pleasant but somewhat vague zone. Has anyone ever had that occur? Yeah, that's common. And having the interest in inquiring, seeing what's happening, can bring life to our practice. And this particular practice we're exploring today can do that in a big way. Really, really interesting. And then the third kind of practice or way of being mindful is to see patterns, is to start seeing. Some of this can occur with reflection, to see, how does this lead to this? What's the pattern? And are there broader patterns? So some of this can occur in reflection. Oh, what happens when I don't like something? Where does my attention go? Again, some of this is a little more remembering and reflecting, but some of it can also be noticed in the moment. You know? So the word in the original language for that I translate as feeling tone is vedana, V-E-D-A-N-A. And it's usually translated, I think unfortunately, in the standard translations as feeling, which is one of the most confusing words in the English language, because it can either refer to thoughts, emotions, or body states. How's that for clarity? Right? You know, I can feel something in my body, I can feel something in the sense of thinking it, and I can feel in the sense of having an emotion. So I think none of those are what this is about. This is about the sense of pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. Of course, feeling tone is not, you know, an ordinary English term, so... But it's kind of a technical term, but it gets at, I think, what we're looking at, the sense of pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. And it's interesting to explore the feeling tone and to see the variety of pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral experiences. That the teaching is that every moment is either pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. In the text, it's called neither pleasant nor unpleasant. I'm using the phrase neutral for that. So the teaching is that every moment is like that. The vast majority of our experiences are relatively neutral. We're pretty interested in the pleasant and unpleasant ones, especially the unpleasant ones. You know, maybe something like 98% of their experiences are neutral. And the reason that this foundation of mindfulness is so crucial is linked to a teaching that many of you know called the teaching on dependent origination or dependent arising. And the teaching is about 12 factors that describe the dynamic of how dukkha or suffering or reactivity continues to occur. And it's rooted in the first factor is ignorance. And basically, I'll give a very, very brief version. There are really three aspects of the model. One is what we bring to experience. The second is what happens in experience. And the third is the results of experience. And clarifying the model can make it really clear how attention to pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral is crucial. So basic teaching, what we bring to experience, when we are... living in a way which leads to suffering or dukkha or reactivity, we are driven to a large extent by ignorance, the first factor, and then the habits, we might say the habit patterns that have developed based on ignorance. Now, ignorance means a kind of spiritual ignorance, not ignorance of facts or information. It's basically we are confused about ourselves and the nature of experience. Sometimes talked about as we don't see ourselves clearly, we don't see how things are changing and impermanent, and we think, this is a major part of ignorance, that grabbing after the pleasant and pushing away the unpleasant brings happiness. That's at the center of it. And so on the basis of that ignorance, we develop habits. It might be what we do when someone says something mean to me, or to us, I should say. Someone says something mean, I may have habits on what I do, maybe to defend myself. You know, when I've looked at my practice, one of the key insights I had, and I noticed, you know, we start to notice a lot of our triggers. I noticed one of my triggers was when I thought people weren't listening to me. And I would... sometimes just my own pattern, habit pattern, was to withdraw emotionally from those situations and go to a place of distance moral superiority, where I would look down and not engage, but kind of look down at the situation and judge. That was a major pattern. No doubt had a certain amount of survival value, right? But we all have patterns like this. Essentially, the teaching is this, that we have that kind of ignorance and those habits. And I could say a little bit more, but I wanted to be brief. That's the essence of what we bring to experience when, you know, at least the ignorant part. I would think we also bring some wisdom, intelligence, and so forth. But we, to the extent that we bring that ignorance and essentially bad habits, then what happens in experience is this. There are four stages in terms of what actually happens in experience. The first is that there's contact with some, we would say, object. We hear something, we see something, we think something, some kind of experience that we have, and that's called contact. And it's said that on the basis of contact, there is feeling tone. I have some contact with a thought, an emotion, maybe an interpersonal experience, we could talk about it that way, and I have some kind of feeling tone. It's pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. Now, here's where the importance of this foundation comes in. If I'm not mindful of the pleasant, I will tend to grab after the pleasant. First, I'll tend to want it, and then I'll grab after it. Often that happens automatically, right? Something you like, you see, you just grab after it. We can see this very clearly in eating, especially with kids. You know, I remember watching one kid eat a bowl of strawberries, and they were so pleasant that the hand is reaching for the strawberry well before even the first chew is occurring, right? And I think the pointer is that we do a version of that. You know, maybe not quite so dramatic or evident, but we do that we have something pleasant. Maybe, again, not all particularly negative. I can have a pleasant experience in meditation, and then instantly I say, oh, let's keep that going, or, oh, let's meditate more, which, again, not entirely negative. It could come out of wisdom, but it could be also just reactive, grabbing hold, you know. And the other side of that is that if there's an unpleasant experience, that's probably where we notice it a little bit more, where there's an unpleasant experience, we tend to not want it and push it away. We can notice this very often in interpersonal interactions. Someone says something negative to me that I interpret as negative, mean, unpleasant, and I will react right back, right? Or someone does something, I don't like it, and I get angry and say something judgmental to the person. Or, you know, I do something that I don't like in myself, and I blame and judge myself, right? Any number of ways this can occur. And essentially, the teaching is that every time that we grab for the unpleasant or push away the unpleasant, we're just reinforcing those original habits. This is actually a lot of the meaning of karma. We're just reinforcing the old pattern. And again, you could see that this is really related to that teaching which I often give, the teaching of the two arrows, which is, I think, probably a more obvious way of teaching the Four Noble Truths, or what's right at the center. And that teaching is that when someone has an unpleasant experience, it's like being shot by an arrow. That's called the first arrow. And if one's not mindful and aware and wise with the unpleasant experience, one will tend to shoot a second arrow at oneself or another if you're not paying attention. It just happens automatically because we don't like the unpleasant and we want to get rid of it. Right? And so a significant part of the practice is going to be learning to be attentive and actually stay with the pleasant and the unpleasant. That's a major part of our practice. And probably for a lot of us, especially if you do retreats, we do that. We sit and the body doesn't always feel good. And we don't just instantly try to make the body feel better, especially if we know that harm isn't being caused. It's very helpful to stay with the unpleasant and watch what the mind does when the unpleasant is there, which is hard often, you know, especially when the body is feeling uncomfortable or there are uncomfortable emotions, right? But that's a key part of our practice because we want to study that dynamic. That's what we can do when we, you know, in the practice we did during the guided practice, when the instruction was just be with the notice or put your lookout for the something significantly pleasant or significantly unpleasant, and then watch what happens. So what we can do is when we do that, we can actually notice, oh, I'm starting to push it away if it's unpleasant. I'm starting to grasp. And we can notice that happening. We can also bring this into daily life. You know, I've often told the story, I think, here of my noticing that reactivity with someone who was like a boss in the organization I was part of. And we'd be at meetings, and I would think he wasn't listening to me, and I would react and go into the pattern I described earlier of kind of emotionally distancing myself. And I started to work with that, and I tried to pay attention right at the moment when he would say something, if he did, that I thought wasn't him paying attention to me or listening well. And I tried to notice it, and for a while, you know, I couldn't even notice it because I would just go, a lot of our reactivity is just going, something unpleasant happens, bam, bam, I'm off, right? I just react right away. There's no step of not wanting it, right? You know, it's just instant, and we can't, and there's no step of even noticing the unpleasant. Well, when I went in this situation with the intention to be mindful, and I said, I want to especially notice the moment when maybe he doesn't listen or something happens that I don't like, and I would tune into that, and it wouldn't feel good. But it was almost like noticing something that normally was hidden because the reaction was happening so quickly. That's something we can do in our meditation. And it started changing. I started being able to notice my experience as if in slow motion. Oh, that happened. Oh, I'm starting to feel, oh, that doesn't feel good. Oh, I can notice my mind starting to go to its old reactive patterns. And in doing that, things got illuminated. And I could actually see the pattern. And with the mindfulness, basically, when I would touch the unpleasant and really be there, my mind wasn't driven to react. A little bit like a child having a good cry. You know, it's over, right? And it's very much like that. If you can actually stay, especially in those interpersonal things, which is more emotional, a little bit different when the unpleasant is more physical, right? Then it's... can be a little more challenging, but even there, we can be with the unpleasant, and we can notice the tendency to react in thought. You know, we can sit there in meditation, feeling an unpleasant sensation in the shoulder, let's say. Again, we know that it's not causing a problem, as best we know. And we sit there, and we notice, and we try to just be with the sensation, we notice the thought, this meditation is stupid. Why am I doing this? This is definitely not leading to enlightenment. Yeah. I think I should do more walking meditation. Yeah, we can go on and on like that, but we watch that, and actually if we can stay with the unpleasant, we can see the reactivity starting to form, and sometimes forming. But this is really, we could call this the inquiry I was talking about earlier. We really stay with it and explore it. And it's incredibly illuminating. We watch, we stay with the first arrow, and we watch the tendencies to shoot the second arrow, but we don't shoot it. It's incredibly illuminating and freeing. Do that over and over with your main forms of reactivity. That's a large part of how we get free of the reactive patterns. We also get to see them more clearly, which is a big thing to start with. So, that is why this, you can see, that's why this teaching and practice is so important. So let me say a little bit more about the variety of feeling tones and then some ways to practice. Then we can open things up. So it's interesting just to see how that works. And again, a lot of us may have the thought of meditation being about relaxation and peace and pleasant. And so this is one of my favorite cartoons. It shows a young meditator saying, today I will live in the moment. Unless the moment is unpleasant, in which case I will eat a cookie. So I'm just trying to suggest an alternative. Okay. So study feeling tone. At the end of the meditation, have a cookie. Okay. So one of the interesting things about the feeling tone, about the sense of pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral, is that it's pretty subjective. We can't really say that the object or the experience causes the feeling tone. Although, you know, certain kinds of experiences in the body will often lead to an unpleasant feeling tone. But in other ways, think of something like food. It's very variable. You know, one person, broccoli will be pleasant. Another person will be unpleasant. You know, I heard something, I was listening this morning. Anyone listen to the PBS show called The Hidden Brain? Anyone hear it this morning? It's a very interesting show. And I thought of it because it really illustrates this teaching about feeling tone. It was a psychologist was talking about how children in Mexico learn to like chili peppers. Initially, children do not like chili peppers. But something happens approximately between the ages of 2 or 3 or 5. By the time they get to be an adult, they want chili peppers in all their food. They hate it at first. The feeling tone's unpleasant, but then it becomes pleasant. That's very interesting. They found out that the dogs of the families in Mexico do not go through the same shift. For the dogs, it's always unpleasant. But they still eat it off food with chili peppers because they don't have much of a choice. Certain point, you know. And so another story I heard was of Mantovani music. I have a colleague whose mother really likes Mantovani. I don't know, I probably haven't heard Mantovani but a few times in my life, probably not for 30 or 40 years, so I'm just talking a little theoretically here. But she really liked Mantovani. But he heard a story of a 7-Eleven, I think it was in Southern California, where they had a great number of drug dealers were hanging out in the parking lot at night. They didn't know what to do with the drug dealers. The eventual solution was based on an understanding of feeling tone. They had a loudspeaker broadcasting Mantovani. The drug dealers left really, really quickly. That was based on feeling tone. And so it's very interesting. So it's subjective. Something that we like at one point can be unpleasant and then later unpleasant. One experience that comes to mind for me that illustrates this was when I was in my 20s, I lived in a lot of group houses, kind of community houses. And one of the houses I lived in, I think we had 10 people, and one of the persons who had a daughter as well was from Iraq. And she used to make, often on Saturday nights, all-you-can-eat baklava. Everyone know what baklava is? Okay. A very sweet Middle Eastern pastry. And so we would all love it, but it was very interesting in terms of feeling tone, because all you can eat baklava over the course of the evening, the feeling tone changes. And so I would say, first piece of baklava, really, really pleasant. And of course, a lot of this depends on the intervals between the pieces, but second piece of baklava, still really, really pleasant. Third piece of baklava, if eaten within, you know, fairly soon after the second piece, good but not quite as pleasant as before, edging towards the neutral. Fourth piece of baklava, edging towards the unpleasant. So you see, so it's really interesting to watch that. So again, it's very subjective, it's not based on the object. We often attribute the sense of pleasant or unpleasant to what happened, but it's not really like that. So that gives, that means there's a tremendous amount of freedom for consciousness. So how do we practice with feeling tone? I gave a number of different practices on the sheet. And so there are a lot of ways to practice. I think, you know, one way would be to practice in meditation by, again, looking out for the significantly pleasant or unpleasant, and when it comes up, and work with that. We could also do that in our daily lives, in the flow of the daily life. Say, I'm going to really try to pay attention when something is really pleasant. And you might want to focus especially on the pleasant or especially on the unpleasant, and study it. And watch especially the tendencies to be reactive. We can do that in meditation. And the second practice I gave was to focus on experience moment to moment and explore just how feeling tone is happening continually, moment to moment, which is really revelatory. And just notice how that is so much structuring our experience. Here, you know, here's my experience now. It's kind of pleasant here. And we can also notice how, even just looking at the body, how some parts of the body feel more pleasant, some feel unpleasant. Even if you looked at different parts right now, you would find that. It's interesting, right? And so you can study what's predominant moment by moment. Sometimes you can go and look at reactivity and try to trace it back to an unpleasant experience. That's interesting, right? Because the teaching is that a lot of the reactivity is because we can't be mindful and just stay with the pleasant or unpleasant, right? For various reasons. It's too much, we're caught in our habits, etc. You know, but we can actually trace back sometimes our reactivity to an unpleasant experience, and sometimes learn to be with that unpleasant experience and stay with it and not be reactive. This is actually what peacemakers do. That's one way to talk about what peacemakers do, or people working with conflict. A lot of the expression of conflict is at the level of reactivity, usually coming out of unpleasant experiences. And so one way that peacemakers might work is to ask, let's say, two people in conflict, talk about your experience, which is going to be tuning into the unpleasant, but very possibly without so much reactivity, certainly not with the act of conflict occurring. And so a peacemaker wants to bring the reactive conflict down to the level where they can tune in, being held maybe by mediators and other ways, be able to tune in to what's unpleasant, and that they can hold in a certain way, can actually open up more to compassion than to conflict. Pretty interesting, right, that one can work that way. There's a line from James Baldwin where he says, I think that one of the reasons why people are so caught in hatred is that they know that if they give up their hatred, they will need to deal with pain. So it has tremendous social implications. You know, so much of what's happening socially is the reactivity, and people pay so much attention to that and not to the pain. We can see that in the last election. We see that in a lot of phenomena. You know, scapegoating, you know, again, following Baldwin, racism in large part has that dynamic. Right? And so a lot of implications socially. So we could actually, you could actually do that kind of work with an interpersonal conflict, that can you bring yourself back to what's painful before you were reactive. Maybe it was, that was, you know, like in my example, it was really painful to hear that, right? But I just reacted back, right? And sometimes if you can, if both parties can say that really that was hard for me. If one can actually go to the unpleasant, to the difficult, it will tend to open up compassion rather than reactivity, so that our difficult experiences become opportunities for learning and healing and growth. So how we work with feeling tone makes all the difference in the world, in terms of relationships. And again, there's a lot more that could be said about how to be skillful interpersonally or socially, but the core of this is this model of the model of reacting to the unpleasant. That's why I've taught a few times at Spirit Rock with colleague Kazuhaga. We've taught on the relationship between basic Dharma teachings and the nonviolence of Gandhi and King. And I think that the core is the same, and it's some version of what we're looking at tonight. Learning to be with what's painful, in this case oppression, without having it lead to reactivity, and yet acting firmly. Right? So you can see that this is actually a very profound teaching, camouflaged as not that interesting. And so we can practice in that way. We can, we could be on the lookout for our forms of reactivity, study them, again, go back to see the unpleasant. Let me see what else I have on the sheet. One way to do the practice is to just continually, maybe every 5 minutes, just check in, what's the feeling tone right now? You can do that during the day as well. What is my, what's my predominant mood? And again, to have here to hold this all with kindness and compassion. Especially where we're looking at the difficult or the unpleasant, or where we grasp. This is a hard area for us. This is an area where there's pain, where there can be suffering. And so if we look more carefully at this, we may think, oh gosh, I'm just reacting all the time. And so we want to hold the sort of the new knowledge with some care and some compassion, because it's some of it is looking into how we work with the pleasant and unpleasant can itself sometimes be unpleasant. So we need to hold it. It can be painful, right? We're seeing our habits and patterns, some of which lead to our own suffering and that suffering of others. And we want to hold that with some compassion and care. Let me see if I have an ending. Well, maybe I'll just read some of the text. This again, 2,600 years ago. How does a practitioner abide contemplating feeling tone as feeling tone? Here, when feeling a pleasant feeling tone, a practitioner understands, I feel a pleasant feeling tone. When feeling an unpleasant feeling tone, one understands, I feel an unpleasant feeling tone. When feeling a neutral feeling tone, one understands, I feel a neutral feeling tone. Very simple. But that simplicity leads arguably to the heart of our practice and the heart of what can really lead to opening and well-being, wisdom, and love. So, kind of unexpectedly, paying attention to pleasant or unpleasant or neutral gets right at the heart of what we're doing and can be a very profound practice to stay with for a period of time. So I'll stop there. Thank you. And it's not taught enough, I would say. Not taught enough. I believe. Yeah, because it's so crucial. Yeah. Any reflections, questions, even stories that exemplify this?
What I have found for myself is that I'm a greedy type, so I can be enjoying something pleasant. And for me, the feeling tones change so quickly that it's sometimes hard to even catch the change. Because if I'm enjoying something that I'm wanting, because I know that it doesn't stay. So it's like I can be in the midst of enjoying something. And if I'm not really being mindful, become overcome, the unpleasant feeling tone will come up that this isn't going to last.
Yeah.
And just, you know, and not to make a story of it, for me, one of the examples was my son was only here for 2 days over the holidays.
Yeah.
And we're sitting in the living room together, he's playing music, it's lovely, and I'm thinking this is really great, but he's only here.
Yeah.
And I just said, stop. Because I started to go to the unpleasant that he was going to be gone. And I said, he's not gone now. Right now, he's sitting here. And just put that down as best I could. But sometimes it just comes up so fast that it just knocks me off.
Yeah, so wonderful to notice all that. And the problem isn't the pleasant or the unpleasant, right? The problem is what we do with it, the chains of reactivity. So I think it's, you know, it's legitimate. He's only there for 2 days. You think about that, and unpleasant, maybe in the form of sadness. So the key would be to feel the sadness and then watch the tendencies to react, right? So we're not trying to get rid of the feeling tone. We're just trying to experience it, but to see if we can do that without it leading on to reactivity. So if, you know, sadness could be said to be a form of the unpleasant, right, in this case. And so I just feel, okay, let me feel the sadness. Most likely, if you actually feel it directly, you won't be reactive, interestingly. And if you're, because the reactivity in many ways prevents us from actually feeling what's there, interestingly, right? I think that's related to the James Baldwin quote, right? The reactivity keeps us just caught in loops. And if we actually felt the sadness, we'd say, I'm sad he's leaving, and we hang out with that. But if we do that, we probably won't just go off in some thought chains which get us caught for the next, in a mood for the next 2 hours, right? So that would be the skillful way to practice. Can I feel the unpleasant? Again, the unpleasant is not just the physically unpleasant, you know, unpleasant sensation in the body, what we sometimes call painful or something like that, but it's also the whole range of emotions, right? Could be sadness, anger for many people might be unpleasant, for some it could be pleasant. Right? So, but it's a great example just to notice how that's working.
Really very timely, thank you.
You're welcome.
I had an incident with my housemate over such an insignificant something. I mean, really insignificant. And it was really unpleasant. And my first reaction was, get over it. But I really couldn't get over it. It was really unpleasant. And I couldn't talk to her about it. I actually cried about it. I mean, really insignificant. And it really, it forced me to really sit with it.
Mm-hmm.
And to really come up with some really lifelong issues that really cleared
mm-hmm.
all of it.
Mm-hmm.
But, and I think part of it was, I hate to say because of my practice, because I don't feel myself to be with it. So, thank you.
Right, yeah, which is the key, and to notice the tendencies to go off in a story, so to speak, or a narrative that just keeps you locked in. And then can I just be with that, again, whatever it is, sadness, could be some anger, whatever the emotion is, can I just be with that and stay with it? And then, again, you know, generally, you know, how we respond to the feeling totally could be more primarily meditatively, could be responding externally, saying something, etc. Could be, you know, sort of the model that I like to offer is how can one be skillful and use the inner practices as well as being skillful in communication, action, and so forth. So this isn't just about exclusively doing inner practice, but the inner practice in this area is indispensable.
And of course, the unpleasantness was eventually able to identify it with pain and what caused all that.
Yeah.
And after it cleared, and it really felt cleared,
yeah,
we were able to talk about it and actually laugh about it.
Yeah.
But, so thank you.
It was fortunate, yeah. Thank you.
Well, it took a while.
Yeah, thank you.
I also want to thank you. I had a lot of fun this week doing mindfulness of the body at times that I don't usually do it.
Wow, yeah.
I have a lot of pain, chronic pain issues, and I really was noticing how at some point I'm not tolerating it, and my mind of spacious, oh, I'm going to wait, and I'll stretch, and I'll do this, and I'll do that, and at some point when it doesn't abate or subside, or if it gets worse, my mind just goes from sort of spacious tolerance to a panic.
Yeah.
It's like, oh my God, I can't tolerate this pain anymore. Give me drugs. So it was really fun to catch that moment.
Wow.
When that happened, and then to be able to recede from that and do something non-reactive.
Yeah. So that's obviously a challenging practice, right? You know, it's but just how can you stay with it where you watch that tendency just to not be able to be more spacious with it.
But I also had a lot of fun. And I did today during the sit, doing what was pleasant and unpleasant with the body mindfulness practice. That was really a lot of fun. And I noticed something that I don't think I noticed before, because there's pleasant, neutral, unpleasant, but I guess one of the pleasant parts was noticing a sense of spaciousness when I was noticing neutral, and then I noticed my heart chakra just felt really spacious, and it was so delightful. And when tense muscles were relaxing, I noticed that was also sort of contributing to this feeling of spaciousness.
Yeah.
So it's great. Thank you.
You're welcome. Yeah. I was thinking, you know, you were reminding me of just sometimes how we sometimes may feel at a certain limit in terms of some kind of unpleasant experience, and it's sometimes hard to relax further, right, where we just go into some contracted place. And again, there are limits for most of us of our capacity. I was thinking of an experience which I had often for, I think, I don't know how many years, but at least maybe 5 or 6 years, I was the teacher, along with Native Elder Fred Wapapa, for sweat lodges at Spirit Rock. And anyone go to them?
Oh, yes.
And what I remember, the sweat lodge is an interesting example, because it's a common experience, and I would experience this from time to time. Because it gets really hot, sometimes I would notice my mind just saying, this is too much. This is impossible. And it would be sort of on the edge of freak out or panic reactions, right? And And of course, you know, when we leave the Sweat Lodge, we, you know, we don't, people can always leave, and if someone goes there, we can just help them out and so forth. But I would notice for myself, having had the experience many times, that I would notice if that would come up, I could give myself the guidance to just relax in a spacious way. And I had known from past experience that that would actually often work, right? That there was some way that my mind was just getting tight. And I could say, let me just be with this experience, with the heat and so forth. And it's actually, you know, maybe I would say it's okay and so forth. And I could notice that often I'd be on the edge of kind of a panic and would give, you know, just say, relax and be with it and track that panicky voice, don't give it energy. And when I would have enough mindfulness to do that, invariably it would dissipate. Right, and I just would open to it, and I'd be fine the whole, you know, for the next hour. Right? It was very interesting. And there's some version of that that we may do. Again, I think it's not to say that that should be the case all the time. Sometimes there are just things which are beyond our capacity, and it's wise actually to pull out. Right. So, but it's interesting to experiment where we sense that there may be some capacity there. That's one kind of experience like that. Yeah. Others? Yeah, please. We can wait for the microphone. Give a workout.
Yeah. When I've practiced enough that I have certain experiences that are sort of limited experiences, then I'll try to see the reactivity, go back to the pain.
Yeah.
And then what happens is the reaction.
The reaction?
Doubt.
Like, yeah.
I can't do this. My brain's not right for this.
Yeah.
Any other kind of doubt that can come up, doubts.
Yeah.
And I'd like you to comment on that, the whole problem of doubt, because for me that can really throw me off.
Yeah, the question of doubt. Probably many or most of us know that in the list given by the Buddha, doubt appears on the list of the so-called difficult energies or hindrances as the fifth, and it's often said to be most difficult because doubt can paralyze our ability to continue, right? And so we want to identify it when it's there. We want to name it, you know, to name it. And then we can use our resources as best we can. So one resource would be mindfulness. And if we think of doubt as a form of reactivity, can I study how this works? Let me notice, what does doubt feel like in the body? In other words, don't take doubt on its own terms, which is often a good thing to do with internal states and other people. Okay, and so we could actually notice, what is the experience like? What's it like in the body? You know, do I kind of collapse a little bit? What are the emotions? What are the mental states? So that's one approach, is to be with the experience of doubt, which is different from being caught in doubt. Right? So that's not always easy, but that's one way to go with practice. And then, you know, the usual guidance from the teachings on this is to cultivate more the quality of faith. So whatever is going to help you have a little more energy, whether it's to think of past times when you actually were quite good, you know, had very strong with your energy, or to, you know, different people would find different reflections helpful. It might be to think of your people you regard as teachers or inspiring people, bring them to mind, imagine they're cheering you on or something like that. Right? So that's usually the traditional guidance, is to strengthen the quality of faith, both in that moment and then more generally in your life. Right? So that's the key. This isn't just a matter of that moment, but it's a matter of strengthening that factor in various ways. And again, you could look to a variety of ways to do that. You know, maybe, you know, to be inspired by others, think, you know, read biographies, whatever's going to lead you to have a little more faith, reflection, and their teachings and books. You know, Sharon Salzberg has a book on faith, right, which gives some ways of developing that.
Well, just tonight it helped just to bring down into this whole circle of activity because Dell is very clever.
It's very clever, and it, like I say, it is often seen as the hardest of all this. Doubt could be way, way harder than anger or, you know, grasping or even a lot of fairly hard states. It could be actually harder because it's paralyzing. So I think we have time now for the meta cards.
For Sangha member's husband with prostate cancer. For Sangha member Marion, who is receiving treatment for chronic debilitating pain. For all mental, physical, emotional pains. For Jamie, who passed on 5/29/19 from pancreatic cancer at age 76 in Todos Santos, Mexico. That's probably highly. Metta for John and John, dealing with multiple deaths. Metta for Sai and his loved ones following his sudden death. Metta for, I think it's Soha or Doha, and Amira. For Meg, who is in extreme physical pain, and for Cynthia in Boston with dementia. For Linda undergoing chemo, for Marion receiving transfusions for pain, and for Karen in her grief.
So there's a lot there. Wow. It's a lot. It reminded me of another version of the core teaching that I heard from someone I worked with who was a hospice nurse. And she reported a very sort of glowing woman who was at the hospice, who was a double amputee at hospice. And she had a sign at the foot of her bed that said, pain is a given, suffering is an option. And that's, again, another way to express what we've been exploring this evening. And all these practices go to help us to be more skillful when the first arrow is there. We sometimes call the first arrow pain, and to distinguish that from the second arrow, which we could call reactivity, might call it even suffering, so that we, by opening to the unpleasant as well as to the pleasant, we increasingly live without the reactivity. Or another version of it, I have a little time, another version of it I heard from Sylvia Borstein. She went to a bar mitzvah of relatives in Chicago, and her grandson came along, and he ate some, they had an offering of gefilte fish with horseradish. And this young man, her grandson, hated gefilte fish. But this, listen for this, this is a version of the same teaching. He said, now, right, because you're supposed to eat the gefilte fish with the horseradish, he said, now I know how you can make something horrible worse. Another expression, which we're crossing traditions. So let me invite you, we'll close with two things. One is just to reflect on how you might like to practice in the next week, maybe with one or two of the practices on feeling tone. Just reflect how you'd like to practice, what you'd like to focus on. And how many of you would like to focus some on what we've been exploring tonight in the next week? You can raise your hand. Okay, great. And then secondly, feeling your own kind heart. Being with that kind heart and offering the benefits of our evening to yourself, to those in your own circles, and then together we offer the benefits of our evening to all other beings, so that ultimately we offer the benefits to all beings, which includes us. Thank you. Thank you for sharing this wonderful teaching and exploration. It really is. I enjoy teaching this a lot. This particular, most things I enjoy, but this especially.
Thank you, John.
Thank you.